The hot Moroccan sun beat down on the travelers as their horses and donkeys struggled up the steep, rocky slopes. Languishing in the burning heat, 64-year-old Ion Perdicaris decided that he was nearly as uncomfortable and unhappy as his mount.
The American millionaire and his British stepson, Cromwell Varley, had been unceremoniously kidnapped from their home outside Tangier just the night before. And for the last 20 hours, they'd been forced to ride through the rugged Moroccan countryside without rest.
Now, wearing a heavy Moroccan robe and turban over his own European-style clothes, Perdicaris was sweaty, tired, and irritable. To make matters worse, the saddle on his horse was rotten, sliding around and threatening to break at any moment.
As the caravan picked its way up a steep hill, Perdicaris' horse slipped on a loose rock. It tried to recover its balance, but the bandit, holding its bridle, didn't realize what was happening. The animal reared, and Perdicaris felt the rotting saddle snap.
The next thing he knew, Perdicaris was tumbling down the rocky slope. As he slammed into the ground again and again, he could only hope to survive the fall.
By the time he came to a stop, the older man's body was in excruciating pain. He was afraid to move, sure that he'd broken his back and dislocated his hip.
Around the edges of his pain, another fear crept into Perdicaris' consciousness. If he was unable to walk, he'd become a burden to his captors, a drain on their resources, and they very well might leave him in that godforsaken desert to die.
This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can find episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Hostage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
Well, at Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help.
This is our final episode on the kidnapping of 64-year-old Greek-American millionaire Ion Perdicaris. Perdicaris and his 44-year-old British stepson, Cromwell Varley, were taken from their estate outside Tangier, Morocco on May 18, 1904.
That evening, a band of armed Moroccan rebels, led by the infamous outlaw Moulay Ahmed Raisuli, descended upon Perdicaris' home. The outlaws seized the two men, along with the family's horses and guns, before forcing them onto horseback and taking them deep into the surrounding mountains.
In the ensuing weeks, the abduction became an international incident. It quickly escalated to involve the U.S. military and soon came to influence the global politics surrounding Morocco.
Last week, we met the legendary rebel leader, Moulay Ahmed Raisuli, got to know Ion Perdicaris and his family, and delved into the volatile political situation of early 20th century Morocco. We also recounted Perdicaris and Varley's kidnapping.
This week, we'll find out what it was like for the two men to be held hostage for over a month in the Moroccan mountains, while the American public obsessed over the case. We'll also explore the dynamics of international politics at the time, as many of the world's most powerful governments got involved. And we'll see just how far Raisuli would go to get what he wanted.
After the initial shock of the rebel attack, Perdicaris had managed to calm himself down. He was well-versed in Moroccan politics and trusted Raisuli's word when he'd promised not to hurt them. Perdicaris believed that the outlaw simply wanted to use him and Varley, two wealthy foreigners, as leverage for his demands against the corrupt Sultan.
But while Perdicaris trusted Raisuli, he didn't trust the notoriously violent rebels who supported him. As they trekked through the darkness, Perdicaris peered at the faces of the men who rode beside him. It took little imagination for him to envision being killed by these brutal outlaws. But as long as Raisuli was present, Perdicaris felt assured of their safety.
However, around 3 a.m, as they traveled further up the rugged mountains east of Tangier, Varley pointed out that he didn't see Raisuli anywhere. Perdicaris whipped around in his saddle, searching for the outlaw's large, bearded figure. He was nowhere to be found.
Suddenly, any sense of safety Perdicaris had felt vanished. Outside of the watchful eye of their leader, there was no telling what the ruthless rebels would do to their captives.
Perdicaris quietly panicked as they rode further into the darkness, praying the outlaws wouldn't turn on them before Raisuli arrived. But soon, he didn't need prayers. Just as the sun was rising above the stony peaks, Raisuli rode up to meet them. The Moroccan had kept his word.
When the caravan stopped to eat and to water the animals, Perdicaris approached Raisuli. Convinced that the leader would be reasonable, he asked permission to send letters to friends and family in Tangier.
Perdicaris wanted to notify his wife that he, Varley, and their servant were alive and well. But Perdicaris was also concerned about the status of his medication. We can't confirm his specific illness, but he was 64, and as he explained to Raisuli, he was not a healthy man. If he didn't take his medication, he could die, in which case he wouldn't be much use to his kidnappers. And Raisuli, understanding the gravity of the situation, agreed to the letters. Perdicaris was relieved.
By first appealing to Raisuli with his familial and medical needs, Perdicaris inadvertently took an important step towards his own survival. According to hostage expert and field aid worker Sean Bickley, captives are advised to try to build a human connection with their kidnappers, as this will make it harder for the captors to kill them. By invoking his wife and his health, Perdicaris made it impossible for Raisuli to see him merely as a bargaining chip. Instead, Perdicaris appealed to Raisuli's humanity, and eventually to his logic.
Having succeeded in one request, Perdicaris felt emboldened. This time, he offered a strategic suggestion to Raisuli. He proposed sending a letter to request the help of the 2 influential sharifs of Wazan. Perdicaris wanted the 2 men to negotiate the terms of his and Varley's release.
The Wazani brothers, Mulai Ahmed and Mulai Ali, had negotiated the release of British journalist Walter Harris, whom Raisuli had kidnapped the year before. Perdicaris was sure they would be the perfect men for the job, and Raisuli eventually agreed.
As the sun came up, the men continued on as usual. Soon, however, Perdicaris and Varley were forced to put on heavy Moroccan robes and turbans over their clothes in order to hide the fact that they were European. And as the day got hotter, the 2 captives became increasingly uncomfortable.
The caravan of rebels continued to ride into the rugged mountains. The further they went, the steeper and more treacherous the terrain became. And then Perdicaris's horse slipped. The rotting saddle girths broke, sending the 64-year-old man tumbling down the rocky slope.
When he finally came to a stop, his entire body was in pain. He felt sure he'd broken his back and dislocated his hip. He had no idea how he would be expected to continue on. The reality of his kidnapping started to sink in for the first time as he realized that his captors could very well leave him there to die.
Well, fortunately, Perdicaris was able to get back up with Varley and Raisuli's help. Though his entire leg was in searing pain and immediately started to swell, the men managed to secure the saddle with rope before hoisting their injured captive back onto his horse. For the next 6 hours, Perdicaris bumped along the mountain slopes, trying not to scream in agony.
Finally, after more than 24 hours on the road, the men arrived at their destination. It was a remote village called Saradun, tucked high up in the mountain. Hidden among rocky outcrops, Saradun served as an ideal home base for Raisuli and was populated with many of his loyal followers.
As soon as they arrived, around midnight, Raisuli disappeared into his own house, leaving Perdicaris, Varley, and their servant to be handled by his men. The bandits pulled the captives off their horses, gave them each a wool blanket, and threw them into a dilapidated two-room hut, locking them inside.
Perdicaris, Varley, and their servant looked around. The thatched roof was so low, the men couldn't stand up straight. A single window overlooked a stagnant pond, and the entire hut was filled with mosquitoes, flies, and other biting pests.
Exhausted and in pain, Perdicaris simply laid down on the floor and covered himself with a dirty blanket. There was nothing more he could do until morning, so he might as well try to get some rest.
But he couldn't sleep. The bugs kept him awake, and his mind raced despite his exhaustion. He thought of the stories his father had told him of kidnappers in Macedonia and wondered if he'd been overly optimistic in his perspective on Raisuli.
In the dark of the night, his imagination gave into his worst fears. Perhaps Raisuli wasn't the heroic freedom fighter Perdicaris had envisioned, but rather a savage bandit. Perdicaris pictured himself and Varley being starved, beaten, and tortured by the rebels' violent followers. He worried what would happen to his wife, Ellen, who suffered from anxiety. Surely she was beside herself, not knowing if her husband and son were still alive. He hoped that she and the rest of the family were okay.
Perdicaris had no way of knowing that he needn't have been concerned about his family. During the rebel attack, Ellen, her daughter-in-law, and her granddaughters had stayed inside the house, unaware of the situation outside. It wasn't until long after the rebels had left that the women realized what had happened.
When she learned that her husband and her son had been abducted, Ellen sprung into action. Her first call was to the U.S. Consul General in Tangier, Samuel Goumeray. Goumeray went to the Perdicaris' villa in person to ensure the family was okay. Then he posted consul guards around the estate.
When he returned to Tangier, Goumeray conferred with his British counterpart, Sir Arthur Nicholson. The two men realized that the situation in Morocco was becoming increasingly dangerous for foreigners. Journalist Walter Harris's kidnapping had been one thing, but expats being taken from their homes was another matter entirely.
On May 19, 1904, the day after Perdicaris's kidnapping, Goumeray wired the U.S. State Department in Washington, D.C. He described the hostage situation as extremely serious and requested military assistance. Goumeray specifically requested one of the U.S. Navy's man-of-war ships be sent to Tangier immediately. He would need it for political leverage and, if necessary, enforcement.
Goumeray knew that Roosevelt, with his policy of big-stick diplomacy, would not hesitate to use military power to protect Americans abroad. Still, Goumeray couldn't have predicted the president's enthusiastic response.
Roosevelt ultimately ordered not one, but four warships to head to Tangier as quickly as possible. The State Department informed Goumeray that the ships would arrive on Tangier's shores in 3 to 4 days.
Goumeray, however, was worried that the 3 or 4 days was far too long. He knew Raisuli and his men were notoriously violent and believed any delay would put Perdicaris and Varley at risk.
But time wasn't the only factor the U.S. consul had to worry about. They still had no idea what Raisuli's demands would be. And regardless of what they entailed, the concessions would not only have to be agreed upon by the Moroccan Sultan, they'd also have to go through the French.
Just a few weeks before, France and England had signed an agreement that gave France primary European control of Morocco in exchange for British jurisdiction of Egypt. In order not to upset this delicate equilibrium of power, everyone would have to tread carefully, President Roosevelt included.
Gumeret and Nicholson went straight to the French minister, Georges Saint-René Taillandier, and the Moroccan foreign minister, Mohamed Torres. The American and the English consuls made it clear that they expected Raisuli to be given whatever he wanted in exchange for their citizens' freedom.
The French official readily agreed, anxious not to have the situation escalate into violence. But Torres was less sympathetic. After all, his government had an ongoing battle against Raisuli and other insurgents. If they made concessions to one rebel group, it would send the message that the Sultan would bend to all of them. However, none of the officials could make a committed decision until they knew exactly what Raisuli was demanding.
The answer came on May 22, 1904, in a letter addressed to Mohamed Torres. Raisuli had five main demands. 1. The Sultan withdraw all troops in the northern region known as the Reef, where Raisuli operated. 2. The removal of the Moroccan military governor in Tangier, whose family had thrown Raisuli in jail. And 3. For that same man's property to be sold in order to pay a $70,000 ransom for Perdicaris and Varley. Well, that's the equivalent of more than $2 million today.
Demand 4 was the release of a number of Raisuli's men who were languishing in the Sultan's prisons. And as number 5, he demanded to be named the governor of two regions outside Tangier.
When Torres read Raisuli's demands, he immediately refused. Torres knew there was no way the Sultan would agree to such extreme demands. It was exactly what Gumeret and Nicholson feared. Now, until the U.S. warships arrived, they had no leverage. And if Raisuli lost his patience before the ships arrived, they worried he'd execute his hostages before negotiations even began.
High up in the rugged mountains, on the muddy floor of their hut, Perdicaris and Varley slept, oblivious to the fact that miles away, negotiations were underway for their lives. They had no way of knowing that the international press was starting to pick up the incident, or that the U.S. president was sending an entire armada to rescue them. Nor were they aware that their seemingly reasonable captor had threatened to kill them if his demands weren't met.
Coming up, we'll find out how the abduction's high profile made negotiations all the more difficult.
Now, back to the story.
On May 20th, 1904, a day and a half into the kidnapping of Ion Perdicaris and Cromwell Varley, the American press broke the news. Front page headlines screamed about the strange incident involving a U.S. millionaire and a dangerous Moroccan outlaw. And hundreds of thousands of papers detailing how President Teddy Roosevelt was sending naval warships to rescue Perdicaris and his British stepson flew off newsstands.
Americans ate up the thrilling story. It was far more interesting than the Russo-Japanese War, the other foreign incident dominating the news. Not only did it involve romantic characters like millionaires and outlaws, but Roosevelt's aggressive response made the president seem like a conquering hero. The U.S., which had yet to become a major power, was starting to step onto the world stage.
But in Morocco, the situation was far less exciting than the American press made it out to be. 64-year-old Perdicaris and his 44-year-old stepson, Varley, were still recovering from their harrowing trek into the rugged mountains. And Perdicaris was in excruciating pain from his fall off his horse. And to make matters worse, they were being kept in a dilapidated hut full of mosquitoes.
A couple of days into their ordeal, Raisuli came to visit his captives. He brought telegrams and letters from their friends and family in Tangier and in the U.S. But as he stepped into the hostages' hut, he quickly realized Perdicaris was unwell. The older man could hardly move his leg without crying out in pain.
Concerned about how an injured hostage may affect his demands, Raisuli promised to make Perdicaris and Varley's situation more comfortable as soon as possible. The leader even told Perdicaris that, had he known the American was unwell, he would have kidnapped someone else.
Raisuli then laid out the situation to his hostages. He told them about his stipulations and explained that he didn't want anything from the two of them. He would even return the horses and guns that his men had taken from Perdicaris' home. His goal was to use their status as wealthy foreigners to pressure the Sultan's government to meet his demands, nothing more.
But when Perdicaris and Varley heard Raisuli's ransom demands, their hopes were immediately dashed. Both men realized there was no way the Sultan would ever agree to such extreme requests. But they had no control over the situation, apart from sending pleading letters back to Tangier, exhorting Gumaray and Nicholson to do whatever it took to get them freed.
In the meantime, they resigned themselves to life in the mountain village, trying to make the best of a peculiar situation. The naturally optimistic Perdicaris took the opportunity to get to know his captor, curious about how Raisuli could be both ruthless and kind. He quickly discovered that he liked the young Moroccan, who seemed to be everything Perdicaris had imagined.
Raisuli was smart and funny. He offered thoughtful analysis of the Moroccan political situation and demonstrated kindness towards his people. Perdicaris learned about the rebel leader's struggles and soon sympathized with Raisuli's cause. Well, several days into their captivity, the two Wazani brothers, the Sharifs tasked with managing the negotiations, finally rode into Raisuli's camp. As the brothers were respected by all the local Moroccan clans, the French minister had agreed that they would be the best intermediaries to handle the negotiations.
Perdicaris and Varley were elated to see negotiations finally underway. They were even happier to discover that the young men had brought with them much more comfortable amenities.
The older brother, Moulay Ali, had decided to stay in Saradun with the captives and had brought two large tents and plenty of modern furnishings for them all. He'd even brought more servants to look after them.
From then on, Perdicaris and Varley felt like they were staying as honored guests of Raisuli's. Perdicaris stayed in the hut, which was cleaned and outfitted by the servants, while Varley moved into a tent with all his usual conveniences. They dined together with Moulay Ali and Raisuli, and Raisuli's men regularly brought them telegrams and letters.
In just a few days, they had gone from languishing in squalor to once again living in relative luxury. Perdicaris marveled at the change in their luck. But unbeknownst to him, there was a sword hanging over their heads.
While Perdicaris and Varley enjoyed their new comforts at camp, the Wazani brothers began intense discussions with Raisuli. When the younger Wazani brother, Moulay Ahmed, returned to Tangier to inform the authorities of the situation, he had dire news. Raisuli was intractable, and despite his hospitality, he promised the Moroccan government that if the Sultan did not meet his demands, he wouldn't hesitate to kill Perdicaris and Varley.
Gumaray started to panic. It took ages to get anything done with the Sultan's government in Fez, a 3-day ride from Tangier, and the U.S. a world away. Every day, he woke up afraid of hearing that Raisuli had tired of waiting for the Sultan and had executed the captives.
And then, on May 29th, 7 days after Raisuli had first sent his demands, the Wazan brothers sent another message. Raisuli was giving the Sultan 2 days to deliver. If the Sultan failed to do so, Raisuli would slaughter Perdicaris and Varley. Gumaray felt helpless. He could only hope that the Sultan would listen to their pleas.
Well, the next day, on the morning of May 30th, more than a week and a half after Perdicaris and Varley's capture, 4 American battleships sailed into Tangier's harbor. Their huge size awed the Moroccan port, as did their horns and gun salutes. To the small city, it felt like the entire U.S. Navy had come to rescue one citizen.
But the ships had the opposite effect on negotiations. Seeing how invested the U.S. government was in the situation, Raisuli changed his plan. Now, he demanded that the British and American governments guarantee the Sultan's fulfillment of the ransom. In other words, recognizing his advantageous position, Raisuli forced the UK and US governments to pressure the Moroccan Sultan.
In fact, this is a well-known problem in hostage negotiation. In his book, We Want to Negotiate: The Secret World of Kidnapping, Hostages, and Ransom, Joel Simon writes that the best way to keep ransom payments down in high-profile cases is for governments to hide their involvement. As soon as kidnappers are aware a government may be paying the ransom, well, they know they can demand more. So while sending ships to Morocco may have helped Roosevelt pressure the Sultan, it also raised the price on Perdicaris's and Varley's heads.
Needless to say, Roosevelt had no intention of being held responsible for another government's actions. His only recourse was to further pressure the Sultan to give in to Raisuli's demands as soon as possible. And so he ordered another 3 naval battleships to head to Tangier.
But the situation was about to get even more tenuous. On June 1st, around the time that second set of American ships was sailing into Tangier's harbor, a letter arrived at the U.S. State Department.
The letter writer had been following the Perdicaris case in the papers, along with the rest of the country, but had one very important problem with the whole affair. He had been in Athens, Greece, in the early 1860s, and believed he'd met Perdicaris there. And in fact, he could have sworn that Perdicaris had renounced his U.S. citizenship and become a Greek national.
Before he panicked, Secretary Hay ordered his team to look into the outlandish claim. Then, on June 7th, an official at the embassy in Athens informed Hay that he'd found records that would suggest that Perdicaris, or at least someone with the same name, had applied for Greek citizenship in 1862.
Hay realized he had to take the matter to Roosevelt. The president needed to know that it was possible they had sent the Navy to Morocco for a man who might not even be an American citizen.
But by then, it was too little too late. Perdicaris and Varley had been hostages for over 20 days, and Roosevelt had already committed American military might and American honor to their rescue. And the world had responded in kind.
While Sultan Abdel Aziz still refused to cede to Raisuli's demands, the French began to exert more pressure on the Moroccan government. Now able to intervene without offending the French, the British had sent a warship too. The kidnapping had now reached a global scale.
Roosevelt knew that he couldn't back out now, so a decision was made. The U.S. would bury the truth about Perdicaris' citizenship and continue as planned. If something went awry, they could always use the information as a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Up in the mountains, weeks went by with no news, though Perdicaris, now with his creature comforts, had no idea that anything was amiss. In fact, he treated the whole thing as an adventure. He enjoyed talking with Raisuli whenever he could, and enjoyed chatting with the villagers, exploring the area with Varley and Mulay Ali.
He wrote letters to friends and family, and even managed to turn his kidnapping into a business venture. Americans were so captivated by the incident that publications started begging Perdicaris to send them news about his situation. The millionaire agreed to write a first-hand account for popular news and literary publication, Leslie's Magazine.
But Perdicaris's optimistic outlook only lasted so long. One day, soon after, 2 messengers arrived. But these men didn't look like they were sent by Mohamed Torres or any other government. In fact, they looked far more like outlaws than Raisuli did.
The 2 men were representatives of Bou Hammara, another insurgent leader who was challenging the Sultan for the throne. Upon realizing the advantageous position Raisuli had gained with Perdicaris and Varley, Buhamara wanted Raisuli to give him the two hostages. He had arrived at the village in the hopes of convincing Raisuli to hand them over, though he would buy or steal them if need be.
Unlike Raisuli, Buhamara's plan was to hold on to the captives indefinitely for protection, rather than using them as leverage in a negotiation. He believed that Perdicaris and Varley would be useful as literal human shields. Having such important hostages would help protect him and his men.
Perdicaris panicked at the thought of being handed off to another captor. Buhamara had a notorious reputation, and Perdicaris was terrified that Buhamara and his men would treat him and Varley far more harshly than Raisuli. Being kidnapped by these brutal outlaws would also mean losing any hope of release. If Buhamara wanted to keep Perdicaris and Varley indefinitely for his own protection, there was no saying if they would ever see their family again.
As weeks stretched on with no news of the negotiations moving forward, Perdicaris's fear only grew. He was conscious that soon Raisuli would have no choice but to take extreme measures and potentially hand the men off to Buhamara. Something was going to have to change, and soon, if he and Varley were going to get out alive.
Coming up, we'll find out what happened when the negotiations went awry.
Now, back to the story.
By June 8th of 1904, the kidnapping of 64-year-old American millionaire Ion Perdicaris and his 44-year-old British stepson Cromwell Varley had reached a fever pitch.
Seven U.S. warships and one British ship were anchored in Tangiers Harbor, a warning to the small country of what would happen if the men weren't returned. Meanwhile, high in the mountains, Perdicaris and Varley waited for any news. Every day that passed without progress was a step closer to Raisuli handing them over to the even more dangerous insurgent Buhamara, or killing them himself.
Finally, on June 8th, when the men had been captive for 3 weeks, Sultan Abdel Aziz caved under the pressure. He needed European money and support. As much as he didn't want to let an insurgent win, he had no choice but to do what it took to keep the French from either withdrawing or taking over entirely. So, the Sultan ordered his foreign minister, Mohamed Torres, to give Raisuli whatever he wanted in exchange for Perdicaris and Varley's safe return.
Of course, it was far more complicated than that. The Moroccan government couldn't afford to meet Raisuli's demands. And so, 4 days later, on June 12th, Morocco officially borrowed 62.5 million francs, more than $300 million today, from the French government. This gave France even more control over Morocco.
The Sultan was fully aware of what his surrender represented, but the humiliation wasn't over. Raisuli, who'd been burned by the Sultan and his representatives in the past, refused to hand over his captives until all of his demands were met, not just the ransom money.
When the Sultan tried to protest, Raisuli, recognizing his bargaining strength, asked for even more. Now, he wanted to be named governor of four regions rather than two, and again, wanted the UK and US to guarantee the arrangement.
But President Roosevelt and Secretary of State John Hay were starting to get fed up with the demanding Moroccan rebel. There was no way that the U.S. could guarantee such an absurd arrangement. They already felt they had done all they could do to help Perdicaris and Varley. If the situation continued on this infuriating path, Roosevelt determined he'd need to take drastic measures. If anything happened to Perdicaris, the president would demand military retaliation.
Much to U.S. Consul Goumeray's concern, Roosevelt suggested exploring the possibility of a joint military operation with France and Britain in order to punish Raisuli.
Well, meanwhile, in Morocco, Goumeray was losing his mind. The negotiations between the French, the Sultan, and Raisuli went back and forth and round about, and the American consul felt powerless to help. One day, things would look hopeful. The next, he'd despair that they'd never reach an agreement.
But finally, on June 19th, 1904, a month after Perdicaris and Varley's abduction, Goumeray was confident that they'd finally come to a deal. The handover would be held on the 21st, 2 days later.
But by the next day, it became clear that the Sultan's government wasn't acting entirely in good faith, and Raisuli backed out.
Goumeray had finally had enough. His position was growing untenable, and the U.S.'s involvement was becoming embarrassing. How much longer could seven American warships wait at Tangier without taking action? He wired Washington, requesting a formal ultimatum to the Moroccan government that threatened military action. They needed to put an end to this one way or another.
Up in the Moroccan mountains, Perdicaris and Varley still had little concept of what was happening with the negotiations for their lives. Their communications with friends and family told them what was in the news, but nothing more. Goumeray and Ellen Perdicaris had decided that it was best if Varley and Perdicaris didn't know how anxious and concerned everyone was.
But even the optimistic Perdicaris could tell the discussions were taking longer than they should have, and he knew every passing day increased the likelihood of something going wrong.
On June 22, 1904, 4.5 weeks after the abduction, President Teddy Roosevelt and Secretary of State John Hay convened to discuss Goumeray's request for an ultimatum.
The Republican convention for the upcoming election had started the day before, and Roosevelt was keeping close tabs on the proceedings. As the incumbent, his potential re-election was riding on how the event went. And at the time, reports were finding that it was rather dull.
Roosevelt was a dynamic speaker, but his surrogates, however, were not. Many of the president's delegates were disgruntled that the convention was shaping up to be such a bore. They felt Roosevelt was a shoo-in, but the tedious speeches done on his behalf risked losing him the nomination. The convention needed an injection of enthusiasm.
Hay showed Roosevelt the telegram he'd composed to send to Goumeray as the official government position. It read simply, "We want Perdicaris alive, or Raisuli dead."
The strongly worded message would throw down the gauntlet Goumeray wanted. But even better, it demonstrated Roosevelt's signature bravado. It was exactly the boost he needed to sway the mood of the Republican convention.
As soon as the president approved the message, Hay not only sent it to Morocco, but he leaked it to the press. Within the hour, the Republican convention chairman read the ultimatum aloud to the delegates, and the room erupted.
It got the biggest applause of any speech of the convention. Well, this was why they'd nominated Roosevelt. He knew how to rally the country. He wasn't afraid to stand up for the U.S. on the world stage. He was going to bring Ion Perdicaris home.
Despite the fanfare, however, Roosevelt's message ultimately had no influence over the Perdicaris hostage negotiations. Due to the extreme time difference between the U.S. and Morocco, by the time the American president's telegram arrived in Tangier, an agreement had already been reached. The French, the Sultan's government, and Raisuli had finally struck a deal. And the next day, on June 23, 1904, arrangements were made for the handover.
Perdicaris, Varley, Moulay Ali, Raisuli, and a number of his men set out from Saradun at 5 a.m. on June 24, 1904. After 5 weeks in the village, Perdicaris and Varli were elated and relieved of finally be heading home, but the others knew that the ordeal was far from over.
Though Raisuli had ultimately refused to hand his captives over to Bu Hamara, preferring to get his own concessions from the Sultan, Bu Hamara and other outlaws hadn't given up. Word of Raisuli's success against the Sultan had spread, and other rebel leaders wondered if they too could use the wealthy European hostages for their own gain.
Essentially, traveling with Varli and Perdicaris through the desert opened up the possibility that the caravan could be hijacked. Though they had just successfully negotiated their release, the two men were at risk of being kidnapped yet again.
For the next 6 hours, the procession rode north through the mountains and rugged countryside. Raisuli's men kept a sharp eye out for ambushes, especially when they had to ride single file through narrow gullies and along mountain crests.
Though this time, astride their own horses with proper saddles and aware of where they were going, Perdicaris and Varli were able to enjoy the long ride through the Moroccan landscape. Perdicaris couldn't help but be grateful that his leg had been able to heal over the last 5 weeks, or the hours-long ride would have been far more painful.
Around noon, they pulled up just above a semi-fortified mountain village called El Zalel. This was the agreed-upon location of the handoff, but Raisuli, who'd been ambushed far too many times, sent a few men ahead to scout the area. When they returned, they confirmed there were no government troops awaiting them. If anything, it felt oddly empty.
The party rode into the village and found the scouts were right. The only people in the castle, the building where they'd arranged to complete the handoff, were the brother of the owner and a few servants. They welcomed the newcomers with tea and promised that the other party was coming.
As they waited, Perdicaris began to grow anxious. The deal had fallen through so many times that he couldn't help but wonder if it had again. Even more worrying was the prospect that his rescuers had been ambushed by another band of outlaws. If this was the case, the Sultan surely wouldn't pay another ransom.
And even if everything went according to plan, Perdicaris and Varli had been instructed to arrive in Tangier before dark, both for their own protection and for the terms of the agreement. The longer they waited, the more daylight they lost.
Perdicaris's anxiety reached a fever pitch. He demanded to know where the owner of the castle was. The man was supposed to bring the younger Wazani brother, Mulai Ahmed, as well as the ransom money and Raisuli's released men with him.
Raisuli calmly assured Perdicaris that they were coming. Perdicaris decided that if Raisuli wasn't worried, he shouldn't be either. But he couldn't silence his nerves.
Nearly 2 hours later, the party finally arrived. But first, Moroccan etiquette demanded that a second round of tea and lunch be served before they could even get down to business. Perdicaris could have screamed from frustration. The longer things took, the less chance they had of making it to Tangier before dark.
After lunch, Raisuli and Mulai Ahmed counted the ransom money several times in order to guarantee the Sultan hadn't cheated them. Perdicaris's heart pounded as the minutes ticked by. What would happen if they couldn't agree on the amount? Or even worse, if the Sultan had sent the wrong amount of money?
It wasn't until late in the day that everything was signed off and the deal was finally completed. Perdicaris and Varli were officially free to go. Perdicaris' anxiety began to evaporate. He'd known all along that Raisuli would be true to his word about releasing them. Even so, they needed to get on the road before they lost the sun.
As the freed captives, the Wazan brothers, and their men prepared their horses to head back to Tangier, Raisuli pulled Perdicaris aside. He asked Perdicaris to warn him of any danger in the future and promised that he and his men would protect Perdicaris should anyone attack him.
the adventure-loving American couldn't help but be amused by the whole proposition. He wasn't sure if he'd be able to notify the rebel leader of any future peril, but he liked the idea that he had a friend out in the Moroccan mountains. The two men shook hands, and Perdicaris, ever a romantic, wished Raisuli well, watching the outlaw as he rode off into the desert.
Hours later, around midnight, Perdicaris and Varley rode into Tangier and back into the arms of their family. As they arrived in the city, the American ships illuminated the harbor, their flags waving in the summer night. After more than 5 weeks in the rugged Moroccan mountains, Perdicaris couldn't imagine a more beautiful sight.
Ion Perdicaris spent much of the next 20 years of his life writing and speaking about Morocco, especially his kidnapping. Over time, his account became more and more favorable towards Raisuli, contributing to the latter's legend as an idealistic freedom fighter.
The question of his citizenship, however, was never completely solved. The U.S. State Department supposedly confronted him about the issue after the fact, but Perdicaris claimed that he assumed he retained his American citizenship when he took on a Greek nationality. After all, his father was an American citizen. 2 years later, in 1906, the United States passed a law standardizing the rules for American citizenship across all states.
The secret that Perdicaris may not have been a U.S. citizen at the time of the incident was kept under lock and key for decades. The first mention of it outside the government was in 1933, nearly 30 years later.
Well, needless to say, the issue didn't hurt Teddy Roosevelt, whose landslide win in the 1904 presidential election was partially credited to his action in the Perdicaris affair.
Unfortunately, President Roosevelt may have been the only international leader to benefit from the incident. The increased European involvement in Morocco that precipitated from the Perdicaris incident only led to more domestic unrest and international tension.
In the following 10 years, there would be two more international military incidents in Morocco, both of which are recognized as key steps on the road to World War I.
Moroccans continued to push back against both its corrupt government and the European powers. And when Sultan Abdel Aziz was deposed by his brother, Raisuli lost almost everything he gained from the Perdicaris kidnapping within a few years.
But Raisuli's legacy lived on. The mythology of the righteous freedom fighter ultimately paved the way for the far more successful Abdelkrim, who would lead the Moroccan Berbers against the Europeans throughout the 1920s. But it wouldn't be until 1956, more than 50 years after the Perdicaris affair, that Morocco would finally gain autonomy from European colonial powers.
Morocco's path to independence, much like a mountainous road, was long and fraught. But a perilous journey makes reaching the destination that much sweeter.
Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Hostage, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Hostage on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Brian Golub, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Paul Mahler, and Carly Madden. This episode of Hostage was written by Kate Thorman and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.